we flee by turning to totalitarian styles of life. The totalitarian liberal looks for new schools and more desks. The real liberal looks for more difficult books to force upon the curriculum. Like disgust, as they say, but I'm not holding that one. But it's a good definition of the liberal, isn't it? Looks for new schools and more desks. Right. And the villains of the city in this essay, this is an essay called A Statement for Architectural Forum. The villains are Le Corbusier and Frank Lloyd Wright, which is very near your essay here, Roger. Your statements there, you remember your essay about Frank Lloyd Wright here. And the Bauhaus people, and what he calls their mafia sons. Now he's thinking about the architectural mafia here. I mean, our immediate thing would be, I think, the shell buildings on the South Bank. That's architectural mafia. Or where I was yesterday, Leeds Polytechnic. Which, I mean, the gap between those beautiful students, and they really were so terrific. I had a marvelous time. And the building was so incredible. I mean, it was startling. I mean, the building is really absolutely ghastly. It's very modern. And it really is a mafia building, that way. So the Corbusier, Frank Lloyd Wright, the Bauhaus. Now, what he means by that is this. Architecture, which I quote, this is page 239, tends to excite the Faustian and empty appetites. You see how he is so incoherent, rather. He doesn't understand. He's criticizing one of his bases here. Okay? Tends to excite the Faustian and empty appetites of the architect's ego, rather than reveal an artist's vision of our collective desire for shelter, which is pleasurable, substantial, intricate, intimate. That's pretty good. Tends to excite the Faustian and empty appetites of the architect's ego rather than reveal an artist's vision of our collective desire for shelter which is pleasurable, substantial, intricate, and intimate. And in part four of Cannibals and Christians, Mailer returns to something we've looked at quite a bit, that is this gestalt of harmony, which we've seen in Capesh and Cage. That kind of refer to that very abruptly like that. That is the action of relating different kinds of knowledge without waste. Now, can I see this? That everything we've been looking at in terms of the morphology of basic forms, that is the total coherence anyway of the world, the universe in which we live. And our problem is to work out a way of acknowledging that so that it isn't a question of imbalance or dualism or conflict structures. All of which are in fact myths of waste and therefore of entropy. You can take Freud and Fraser and these other figures we've been looking at as myths of waste through conflict structures. You have the idea that all those major structures are entropic ones. They are patterns of entropic philosophy. All the ones we've been criticizing, you understand? So, I think Mailer understands quite a bit about this. But you see how he puts it? He's still hung up on problems to do with, wouldn't that be a very passive structure? Wouldn't morphological harmony without conflicts and dualisms, and here we get to it, war, and here is Olson's hang-up, the beauty of war, wouldn't that in fact be monotonous and entropic? So, this is page 265. This is a dialogue called The Metaphysics of the Belly. Hope, danger, ecstasy, promise, the transcendence of terror, all the motions which give life to us in the West. That sounds to me like, what was that fellow that wrote Marinetti? And other fascist guys. You know, that stuff that Mussolini picked up and built into fascism. That's exactly that kind of thing. I mean, if you read it just like that, without knowing it was Mailer, I would have said immediately, that's those metaphysical apologists for fascism in Italy at that time. Really, I mean, you may not know about that, but that's in fact the truth. You know about it too. Yeah. Okay, hope, danger, ecstasy, promise, the transcendence of terror. All the motions which give life to us in the best. But harmony, I fear, is what beauty is first. Harmony, I fear, is what beauty is first. It means that separate parts function in a lively set of rhythms with one another. No organ is too fast or too slow vis-à-vis another organ. The pleasant relation inspires proportions in the outer forms which are healthy, harmonious, and beautiful. Beauty so runs this argument, has its root in any being, which is harmonious, imaginative, adaptable, brave, artful, good for life, good for the continuation of life. But he doesn't believe that argument. He just can't. He thinks very much that it will in fact be omitting that. You see, in those words, hope, danger, ecstasy, promise, transcendence of terror, is all action, isn't it? Do you notice? Do you see? It is all words which presuppose another state. Okay. So they're all counter-entropy words as far as I'm concerned. Huh? If you see inside all those words, there's that action. Well, then he goes on to say that the trouble with contemporary American society is the pleasure comes from what he calls the modern man's ability to swallow nausea. He said good on this, the way that we train ourselves to put up with things, you know, we swallow it all the time, the shit, the crap, the nausea, the lot, the smog, and the, you know. Now we're doing it. I quit. This is page 269 of this, and this is the same essay. The condition of our existence is now so plague-ridden that we have sunk beneath the level of scatology. The modern condition may be physically so bleak, so overextended, so artificial, so plastic, that studies of loneliness, silence, corruption, scatology, abortion, monstrosity, decadence, orgy, and death can give life. He's very concerned here with the, obviously, with that mass, enormous mass since 1953. I'm thinking of David Reichman's work there, onwards in America, which has been analytical. I mean, God knows how many books must have come out since the early 50s in America, analyzing American society. His point is, and I would agree with this, that the whole of it, everything that's been put in is apparently entropic, because nothing really has happened at all. It's a very curious sense of an entropic misbalance by information and communication. You can load your circuits with information to the point of overloading, and that is suicidal.
He's saying that there would have been changes if there hadn't been a book?
I think he's saying that the overloading is the point. Because in fact it comes from so many different points of view, and it makes the life of the existential hero too difficult. Excuse me, I've got a damn hay fever thing going on me. So, he says the worst form of entropy though is the compromise, and this is how you get rid of it. You must engage death, perversion, promiscuity, and the fear of hell before you'll get better. Your health is to eat the body of your mate. Your secret desire is to be trampled in an orgy. This is what the oracle of the unconscious, notice, the oracle of the unconscious, it may divine from the feces. No wonder shit is despised. Its message is too terrible. Now, I think he perceives some of his own hang-up on this one, on page 340. This is right at the very end of the book. Discussion of it here. This is another one of these long interviews. I can't think what this one is called. Doesn't matter. It's right at the end. Where he is making a dialogue with his alter ego here. And the other guy who's challenging him says, there's a ladder of dominations you seem to be always about to construct. A ladder of dominations, notice, which is a power structure, obviously. A ladder of dominations you seem to be always about to construct. Spirit dominated by a soul, who in turn is dominated by a higher spirit, which is in turn dominated by a yet higher soul. Now, here's Mailer getting very near to his intuition, to his own search for absolutes, you see. This endless ladder of dominations. out to the God thing. And in reply, Mailer tries to release himself from the drama, this drama of soul and spirit as domination structures, consciousness, unconsciousness, God, devil, and so on, conflicts. But they quite obstinately remain. The fact is, his sensibility, and you see how I'm getting reductive here, because I can't see any way of putting it except temperament and sensibility, apparently is combative, dualistic, embattled, ambushed, and alert. He is the hipster. And this is as far as he gets. This is page 346. And I think this is very interesting to me. Notice the language here. This goes right into an American dream. Our soul needs beauty for its growth. If there is a God and a devil both, and God creates beauty, then the devil must attempt to steal it. That devil whose pleasure is to defeat possibility, deaden hope, waste effort. But then he goes on to say, if you don't grow your soul, you, I quote, pay more for remaining the same. Now his idea then is that remaining the same, of course, will be entropic, because there's no temperature change. The sameness is because of the loss of heat energy. But in order to counteract that, you enter the dualism, which was also wasteful. It's a very despairing position indeed. Like the Manichaeism of entropy and the monotony of it. Now here Mailer is really getting down to the entropic problems of the conversion of energy without loss. That's what he wants. What worries him is this, that beauty can destroy the soul's possibilities by making it timid and unchanging because of the lack of tensions in total harmony. For Mailer, then, the tragic, then, that's his word, is this tension, and it's absolute. I quote, the soul detests death and abhors suicide. But deep in the economy of being, huge waste must be caused by any indiscriminate odyssey of souls, any incoherent metamorphoses. That is the absolute center to my mind of Mailer. There are two bits. The soul detests death and abhors suicide. But deep in the economy of being, huge waste must be caused by any indiscriminate odyssey of souls, any incoherent metamorphoses. That's as far as he's gone, I think. And I need to say I admire him intensely, but this act of penetration fascinates me. And these dialogues in Cannibals and Christians where he like nags at it and gets himself down, fascinating. But of course, he adds, eternity desires tidiness. Now, tidiness is entropic. Right? That's craftsmanship. And again, he doesn't see that. Not as a passion, but as a use, as a most useful function. But of course, one has to say to me then that the completeness in any system, the total completeness is total entropy. It is stasis. It's purity, perfection or something, which is dead. So, I think that if you read this book, you have as good a description as you'll get of the contemporary problems of tension and entropy in American society and elsewhere. I think the trouble is, and you may have noticed this straight away, the male sense of the environment is very thin. It's very abstract kind of arguments, it seems to my mind. That you get the feeling that he always wants to operate from positions of over-clarity himself. That he's not too keen on muddle as a non-entropic idea. But nevertheless, there's no question to my mind about his ability to find language and memorable phrases to harness this kind of thing. Let me remind you, finally, of the story that ends Cannibals and Christians, or practically. And it's a marvelous story about the guilt, which, in fact, is also deep down inside his work in Americans, I think, generally about their society of this liberal ilk. Now, this story, which concludes Cannibals and Christians, continues this tradition of being responsible for the cosmos and feeling responsible for setting in action some kind of change. Remember, it's called The Last Night, and it deals with the guilt of those who have polluted the world with nuclear radiation and fallout. And this is to be alleviated by starting men again in some distant planet beyond this universe. The first rocket that they try entropically burns out. That is, its energy steadily disperses. It gets into outside the universe. It's finished. Right? That is due to friction needed to create its own velocity. The rocket to succeed this one will have to have the power of the explosion of the Earth itself if it is to defeat entropy. So this story is a myth of Mailer's own tensions, isn't it, immediately, see? Obviously, if the only way out is to clear yourself of the issue of the Earth, and the only way to get that rocket off is to clear yourself of the Earth, the atmosphere, you've got to get rid of the Earth. Extraordinary idea, this. Since God is in man, man must not be destroyed, is the idea. Since God is an invention of human beings, that is, he must in fact find a way of, using the Blakean Olson terms, of perpetuating that in man which is the possibility of the fourfold man. This is countered in the story by the president's wife, who says, "You would destroy the world for a principle. There's something diabolical in you." But, the story goes on, if beauty is possible, and men have a right to dream of a better future, this rocket must be energized. If you don't believe in it, you see there's a trap situation here. If you don't believe it's possible to go beyond pollution and take the risk to go beyond pollution by blowing up the Earth, nothing will change. It's a real circular trap structure. The rocket must be energized for the rebirth principle. And then it's said that the memory of the sacrifice of those left on Earth for the rebirth principle will be the force to change men. I quote, "Man may become human at last." It's the ultimate sacrificial act. In fact, looking at it one way, it's the ultimate war, isn't it? It's the war against everybody, by everybody. Which is damn near where we've got to now. This is simply an extension of the monstrousness of now. Everybody thinking that they have, in fact, the right to be phoenixes. The vote is taken, notice, very democratic, all these beautiful votes always like to stamp on you. It's taken to destroy the Earth with universal consent. And the president radios the people as he rushes with his fellow examples of human potential in space to pray that their purpose is good and not evil, because he doesn't know. But at that moment, he seems to hear his dead wife's voice saying, "You'll end by destroying everything." Now, you'll notice here that all that Mailer can say here in his uncertainty is to hope that this act is not caused by the devil. Which is what the president says as he goes rushing off into outer space. It's a rocket vanishing at the end of the story into darkness as an act of faith and an act of uncertainty, and possibly as an act of arrogant delusion. But neither of those three things is pinpointed separately. It's all three, possibly. An act of faith, an act of uncertainty, and possibly an act of really arrogant delusion. In our terms, then, of the myth of entropy, Entropy here is solved temporarily by the removal from one dead place in the universe to a place where there's a chance of not being dead. You use the total energy of the Earth to keep the imbalance of energy going in the universe. In fact, I think Mailer's story could be considered the dramatization of a passage in A.N. Whitehead's book, Science in the Modern World, which I want to read to you. We've been looking at Whitehead in connection with Olson last week. This is chapter 6 of Science in the Modern World, 1925, where Whitehead speaks of the component of, I quote, the evolutionary machinery, which he calls creativeness. The organisms can create their own environment, he said. For this purpose, which is what that rocket's doing, potentially creating its own environment. For this purpose, the single organism is almost helpless. The adequate forces require societies of cooperating organisms. But with such cooperation, and in proportion to the effort put forward, the environment has a plasticity which alters the whole ethical aspect of evolution. That rocket of Mailer's is taking evolution into its own hands, notice. In the immediate past, and at present, a muddled state of mind is prevalent. The increased plasticity of the environment for mankind, resulting from the advances in scientific technology, is being construed in terms of habits of thought which find their justification in the theory of a fixed environment. That is a main criticism of Mailer's story. The increase in scientific technology is being construed in terms of habits of thought which find their justification in the theory of a fixed environment. Romantic ruthlessness is no nearer to real politics than is romantic self-abnegation.
Yeah.
Which is like statement in Whitehead, isn't it, here, you see? I would say that Mailer's position is one of romantic ruthlessness. With a great deal of respect and admiration, I say that. I think he's so important that he's so dangerous too. Romantic ruthlessness is no nearer to real politics than it's romantic self-abnegation. This is Whitehead.
Often they go together.
Right. It's that terrible... Yeah, right. Oh, I didn't say any more. Okay. Oh, Lord, I've been slower than I thought. But I just begin this, because I think it's important, because otherwise I'm going to lose contact completely here. What I want to do is to get down into problems, then, of this relationship between romantic self-replication and romantic ruthlessness as the mythology of nihilism. That is, this mythology of entropic destructiveness, which I think is in fact really the center of the political plague right now. I think I just won't go into this. I recommend you a book and leave it to you to do it. It's a book called Man's Rage for Chaos: Biology, Behavior, and the Arts. Man's Rage for Chaos: Biology, Behavior, and the Arts, 1965, by a man called Morse Peckham. P-E-C-K-H-A-M. Morse Peckham. Man's Rage for Chaos. This, by the way, is a challenge, Nigel, to Wallace Stevens' celebrated lines in The Idea of Order at Key West. Remember? Oh, blessed rage for order. Where Stevens takes it for granted, doesn't he? Morphologically, that human beings can't help but create order. Morse Peckham suggesting that if you say they can't help creating chaos either, you have the self-defeating antithesis, which means you've got to find a third term. Huh? It seems to be a radical criticism of Wallace Stevens and the idea.
Yeah.
Don't you think so?
Although, he does argue it out with himself.
Oh, I guess I'm not to eat out very much.
And he is loath to make universal statements. Hmm.
But he does.
But he does make
them. Particularly in the idea of Order at Key West.
Yeah.
I mean, the basic arrogance in the idea of Order at Key West, to my mind, is that the sea needs ordering.
Hmm.
Now, that seems to me silly. for a start off, because there's not the slightest suggestion that the components we call C and its movement are not controlled. It seems to me an arrogance that somehow you make music or poetry out of the C in order to cohere it, to see it on our terms. In fact, one could say that by making music out, or a song or a poem or whatever, as Stephen says, out of it, you are creating chaos. You see, this is the argument here.
Elsewhere.
That art is something else. It's technology, in fact. It isn't nature, and it isn't the imitation of nature.
But
sorry.
Why is it that elsewhere he abandons all the ordering devices he can think up in order to get at the stage where the world just becomes an organism, self-ordering? Fit heroes into structures. He won't. He won't name things. He won't describe the whole thing.
This is this thing about the pineapple, which he gave in that paper at Harvard, isn't it?
Yeah.
That one. That's right at the very end of his life, yes, you're right. No, I wouldn't make sweeping generalizations about Stevens. He's on that poem, the idea of order at Key West, which is a very important one. Those of you who don't know that poem, please let me recommend it by Stevens, the idea of order at Key West. Because it's the one poem one knows in Stevens where everything we're talking about is focused. I mean, do you really think that is the function of art and technology, you see, or not? It's a very important poem indeed. Well, Stephen is a very important writer. That question I was wrong again and again about that. Boy, I feel so ashamed of that one. Okay, let me just finally mention one or two things about Winners and End of Stop, because I did want to go right through into this man. I really must. I'm talking here mainly about the book called The Human Use of Human Beings. I know what Wiener. Which came out in 1950 originally. The edition that most of you have looked at, I expect, is the revised edition of 54. One of the most influential books of the century. No question about this. What I'm concerned with is the influence of it, really, more than anything else. Because I think the ideas are very, very simple. But I think it's a classic case of a book becoming a myth and being applied as a way of preventing change, which is so ironic, which is unbelievable. Norbert Wiener's book deals with the applications to machines and to human society as different kinds of system of the second law of thermodynamics, which talks about the loss of heat energy in any system being a necessity in physics. This has become the myth of the necessary running down of any system, and the myth of liberal inertia in American politics, that all you can do is pile up endlessly descriptions of the running down process, and you call it the lonely crowd, all those books by Vance Packard, you know,
Organization Man,
and so on, all of which overload the communication lines to this point of entropy. Just a point.
As long as you got rooms and desks, it's okay.
Right. But I do advise you very strongly to watch the language of entropy as it's used to perpetuate this catastrophe, masquerading as liberal analysis and criticism. It goes on continually. I mean, in this country, it's called a magazine called New Society. We're talking here about the way, in fact, social analysis is used to reinforce the structure of disaster. And the central myth is entropy, the myth of inertia and intellectual smugness. The one application of the second law of thermodynamics is described in a book which some of you may have heard about already, which is a very useful history of the laws of thermodynamics. I think you have it there, don't you? So you can show it to people afterwards if you will, Patricia. It's by Angrist and Hepler, A-N-G-R-I-S-T, Angrist and Hepler, H-E-P-L-E-R, called Order and Chaos, Laws of Energy and Entropy. Angrist and Hepler, Order and Chaos, Laws of Energy and Entropy, 1967. Now, the one thing that that book does is to, it talks about definitions of order and disorder, and what it ignores completely is the thing that we've been looking at, that is the basic proposition of order as morphology. It ignores it completely. In fact, again and again, what they mean by order in that book is simply social order based on certain kinds of society. It's a classic case of two scientists playing back the idea of order into their own scientific work from concepts of social order. It happens continually in scientists. Their laboratory, in fact, becomes the image of social order. And their, quote, experiments, unquote, take place in that social order. Social order then may be seen, society may be seen then as, given the second law of thermodynamics, as a local entropy reduction. A house, for instance, can be seen as a local entropy reduction. Whereas the universe is running down, the sun is cooling, and so on, says this idea, the fact that the house isn't a pile of bricks, pieces of wood, panes of glass, means it is a local reduction of order, of disorder, sorry, local reduction of disorder. In the same way as any organizational device in action reduces entropy. But then you see Angrist and Hepler say this: the general and universal trend of entropy to increase easily swamps the anomalous but important effects of civilized man. Each localized man-made or machine-made entropy decrease is accompanied by a greater increase in entropy of the surroundings, thereby maintaining the required increase in total entropy. That's what I mean by myth. Now this myth is based on physics laws. That's page 200 of Angrist and Hepler. You can see immediately the danger of this. I want to be really straight on this one with you. I would say, even if that were true, it has nothing whatever to do with happiness. And if you think that's sentimental, I'm sorry. Do you see? It seems to me, I would say, if it were true, but it isn't, it would be irrelevant. I mean, but I better ask quickly what I mean by that, because those of you noticed Arnold Goldman and I were just about to get going when we were put down Saturday before last, there are in fact two other theories of the universe, one of which is the steady state structure of continuous creation. The other one is of continuous creation. I mean, one is steady state, the other is continuous creation. Now, they have not reconciled at the level of physics yet the second law of thermodynamics with the condition of steady state and of continuous creation. Do you see what I mean? So I mean, my point is, if you choose to have this myth going, you choose. And if you choose to apply it to human beings and society, you've chosen to do it. And if you choose inertia, you choose inertia. And if you make a myth of it to reinforce it, it's a political act. Huh? Just that. It's very interesting. I would like to put in here, but you may check this yourself. If you take David Riesman's book, The Lonely Crowd, as a book about entropic perpetuations of society, I think you'll get it straight. Because, you know, he has that structure inside the book of the different kinds of men I won't go into now. But finally, he talks about somehow the possibility of living as a self-regulating, automatic man at the end, remember, within a society which meanwhile hasn't changed around you. This is the dream, this is the liberal bourgeois dream. You can set up anti-entropic structures inside a decaying situation. You can actually do it. Now you actually can't, for all sorts of reasons, which are largely, I suppose, one can call the suppressed chapters of Robinson Crusoe. I mean, you know, the chapters on solitude, which demolished the whole thing as a Bible proposition.
Yeah, sort of going off into the big thing.
Right. There's this dream that you can find a log cabin somewhere. You're sitting there, isn't it? And then the world decays around you. In actual fact, what happens is exactly what happens in Finchon story entropy. The temperature outside and inside levels up. You don't have to smash that pane of glass. It happens. This is, to my mind, an appalling myth of tremendous traction in America at the moment. Because it makes a sort of set of alibis for decay, do you see? And the guy says, well, like, you know, that's how it is. That's the way your cookie crumbles, second law of thermodynamics, huh? That's how terrible. Well, really, it happens. Kind of terrible, isn't it?
That's like bad cooking.
Right,
yeah, right. The gas too high or too low.
Right. Or too much salt. Yeah. Well, I think I'm going to leave it there. Because I think, well, next week what I want to do, I just have a few more notes. And I'll finish off with the first section, this entropic star, by moving into the area where Norbert Wiener suggests the true state of this myth. Then I'll stop it, and then we can spend the rest of the day, if you want, discussing the various things related to the course. Because next week we can go on, if you like, until lunchtime, and by me until 1 o'clock, because I don't have any classes on after this week to teach in the college.
Which book of Whitehead is that quotation from?
Science in the Modern World.
Science in the Modern World.
And it's chapter 6. Right.